Morning. First case of the morning is Linda Rodriguez versus Olin. Ms. Fisher.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Nancy Lisher, and I represent the defendant appellant, Olin Employees Credit Union. As this court knows, this case involves a situation where the plaintiff placed, or shall I say misplaced, her entire trust in a single employee to manage her finances, post insurance checks, and maintain the computer system that she converted to in 1992. Starting with that conversion, that employee, Carol Wiltshire, stole from the plaintiff and cashed or deposited these checks at the defendant credit union. The issue I would like to address today is whether the district court erred in applying the judicially created tolling doctrine, the so-called continuing tort or single transaction theory, to delay the commencement of the three-year statute of limitations.
Ms. Litter, shouldn't the bank have attempted to take some truly independent action to verify Ms. Wiltshire's authority to cash the checks? I mean, for example, by contacting the doctor herself in order to verify the authority here.
Well, Your Honor, first, even the plaintiff's expert agreed that by asking for a notarized letter, which occurred in either 92 or 93, that was the second letter, that this was, quote-unquote, independent verification. He also said, well, it could have been mailed from the plaintiff, but of course, this would have been no obstacle for Wiltshire, who had complete access and was the office manager. Second of all, with 2020 hindsight, can you say, well, they could have picked up the phone, they could have done this, they could have done that. But I submit that the plaintiff also could have picked up the phone, asked for an outside accountant, could have asked another employee or an outside consultant on this computer program.
Of course she did consult with a number of different accountants, and apparently none of them suggested that she conduct an audit of her records. So, you know, why should she be faulted for not thinking of that herself?
Well, first of all, she contacted one set of accountants. She never asked for an outside investigation or an outside audit. She said, how come I'm not making a profit? And they got into a discussion about insurance reimbursement. So there really was not a situation where she ever sought to have anybody independent other than the single employee control or look at her finances. And I have cited the cases that say the failure to get an outsider to look at this alone shows a failure to use due care or ordinary care, which under the code is defined as reasonable commercial standards.
I'm concerned as well about what the bank did, that it seems to me this issue really goes to the 90%, 10% allocation of responsibility as opposed to the statute of limitations, since even if the credit union did violate all manner of duties toward her, there's still a question for what period of time is her suit still alive. And I wondered, of this $372,000, how much is represented by the period that you argue lies within the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, I estimated it on my brief at page 2. $235,900 are barred under the statute of limitations. The exact figure, to be honest, maybe in this, well, we know the exact figure can be calculated based on this record because the checks themselves have been Xeroxed and they're binders.
Page 3, yeah.
Lots of binders of checks, and I can provide that afterwards if the court
would like.
No, maybe
this is close enough.
Okay. I concur, Your Honor, that this is a comparative analysis, and here's the problem and why the 90-10 was incorrect. The district court misapplied the law when it came to the risk of loss and when it came to the standard of care. It imposed the risk of loss, really, on the defendant. It said the defendant, quote, allowed the scam to run at page 20, slip opinion.
But the problem is with third-party checks, it's not like first-party checks that you get back. They would go back to the insurance company if they're paper checks at all, as I guess these were. So it really might be the credit union that's in the better place to detect irregularities with these third-party transactions.
That would be true under pre-1990 law, but that is no longer true with the 1990 amendments that were adopted in 92 by the state of Illinois. So what you have is a situation where beforehand they looked at the bank's fault. Now they impose the risk of loss first and foremost on the person in the best position to stop the fraud or the embezzlement, and that is the employer. So that's where the court erred, because it effectively said the credit union should have stopped this.
Well, the 92 change doesn't change the fact that each of these two parties is in some position to prevent the loss. And I'm just saying that in the case of third-party checks, the credit union is itself able to take protective measures, and this credit union seems to have operated more on handshakes than on rigorous procedures.
Well, the truth is they had a policy, and that policy was followed. It was up to the supervisor's discretion. In hindsight, 2020 hindsight, there are a lot of things that could have been done. But under the UCC, they look at the comparative fault. Well, so you can't just look at this credit union. You have to look at what the plaintiff failed to do. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, not at all. Just to add, you know, to Judge Wood's point, you speak of supervisor's discretion, and we have to think about judge's discretion here. And when you have two parties that both are at fault, we, you know, take a good look at a judge's discretionary decision. And there are points to be made here on either side. And one, of course, for the doctor is that Olin never went directly to her for confirmation. And they relied on the thief to supply the apparently forged letters of authorization.
Well, here's the problem. The plaintiff, according to the district court, was not held to what is defined as ordinary care, which is reasonable commercial standards. The court said, well, she's a doctor. She did the best she could in operating this office. But the truth is, and he also said, well, she's not a computer expert, which sort of ignores the fact that Wiltshire had a high school degree and also wasn't a computer expert. But the problem with imposing or letting the plaintiff escape from her responsibility to supervise and monitor her own office, she is in the business of running a medical practice, and that involves that involves insurance records, sending bills, invoices, totaling out when the insurance won't reimburse as much. You have to make these adjustments.
And she obviously has to know what she's billing and for what.
She should absolutely monitor her own record. And in fact, the only evidence in this record, Your Honor, about what is the standard of care for a physician in a solo medical practice was that of the computer expert who said, look, and he had trained nationally, and as of 1995 was the only person in the country who did this because that program was not Y2K compliant. The sole evidence in this record about what is the standard of care for solo practitioners, doctors, is that they beat down the door trying to learn their program. They want to know what their finances are. They want to understand how these things work. But according to her brief, there was no evidence in the record suggesting that she was ever told what Dom's report she should review. And if that's true, then how can she be faulted for not printing out and reviewing various types of reports that your brief suggests she should have consulted? Well, can I make an analogy, Your Honor? She was obligated to use ordinary care, reasonable commercial standards, which is to monitor, supervise, and understand her own finances. And the fact that she wasn't told what to do does not mean that she could ignore everything. If I was standing at a street corner and the traffic was rushing by and I decided to cross it and somebody didn't say, don't cross the street, and I decided to cross it anyway, obviously it would be a lack of care on my part. You have to look at this record because her actions show that it was a complete abdication of responsibility in favor of Wiltshire. It was a complete failure to monitor her own financial records. She chose not to be trained. She chose not to understand her own business. There was a complete failure to supervise employees. By 1997, Wiltshire had trained Denise Rodriguez, who revealed the theft, and yet she didn't even go to the only other person, apparently, who did learn the system to find out what was going on.
Would you address the statute of limitations before you go?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor.
The issue of they claim that Field is on point, and your position is that the Supreme Court of Illinois has basically changed that and restricted it.
Correct, Your Honor. Belleville, I believe, was a 2000 decision by the Illinois Supreme Court. Field was in the early 90s, and I believe the hottest case, which was really a discovery rule case, was 1997. Starting with Cunningham, which construed a medical malpractice statute of limitations, this issue about continuing tort or the single transaction rule started to arise. The Fifth District downstate created this rule saying it had searched nationally and found no cases which applied this doctrine, but it would, and it did this by looking at I think federal conspiracy law and other things. What happened in Belleville, Your Honor, is that the court said, look, there is no general continuing tort rule of general applicability. That's not in existence in the state of Illinois. And then in that case, it was monthly allocations of cars over years and years. And the court said, because each allocation would give rise or support a separate cause of action, the plaintiff could recover damages within the statute of limitations. And this is exactly our point here. Once the conversion claim arose, which happened upon the cashing of a check, and that's not controverted on our record, the plaintiff agrees that once the check was cashed, this gave rise to a claim based on conversion. Because each distinct check that was cashed or deposited, and I should emphasize or deposited because it happened both ways, and the same analysis would apply, gave rise to a cause of action. And with each check, there was also an ascertainable amount of damages, which is the amount of the check. If Wiltshire had cashed or deposited a single check, they could have sued on that. So that's our point, is that the Belleville analysis, that because each act would give rise to a separate cause of action, that's why the statute of limitations would start. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Winsig?
Good morning, Your Honor. I would like to address a couple of issues that the court inquired of opposing counsel. First, to give you a little more background on the continuing violation rule and its application to Section 118G.
Right. I'm glad you're going to start with that because I have to say that the rationale not only of Belleville but more broadly in the law, which I think would influence the Illinois courts, is to distinguish situations where you don't really even know you have a claim until you've seen a pattern arise, such as the abuse case, such as harassment cases like the one the Supreme Court of the United States had before it in the Amtrak against Morgan situation. And in those instances, to apply the continuing violation rule, whereas in contrast, in situations where discrete acts give rise to claims,
one has a claim on each one of those, so you can reach back as long as the statute of limitations goes for each one of them. But in Dr. Rodriguez's case, that would mean 3 years back from 2000.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, there has to be a distinction first in this context between the discovery rule and the continuing violation rule.
Well, why? I mean, I understand that the discovery rule has to do with at what point does the statute start to run, either when you discover, when the event happens, and I take it you're not contesting in any way that the discovery rule has no application to the UCC.
Correct, Your Honor.
Because, of course, you would lose under, you know, the law is against you on that, so you have to find a different theory. But the policy motivating that particular rule under the UCC, commercial reliability and ascertainability, is quite similar to the policy that would govern whether each individual check is a separate point on which a suit could be brought or whether there's a continuing violation. And I take it under your theory, if Wiltshire had been there, you know, suppose Dr. Rodriguez is a much older doctor and had begun practicing in 1967, and Wiltshire had been working for her all this time, then you could go back to 1967 from when this lawsuit was brought.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, if you look at Feltmire, it covered a much larger period.
But
than
I don't
the
think
period.
Feltmire.
We're talking about the Feltmire case.
Please try to stay in front of the microphone, please. Thank you.
Feltmire is emotional distress. It's one of those things where you might not have the claim. I really think the underlying facts of Feltmire are quite different from those of a commercial transaction under the UCC.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and if I may, and this goes to why Belleville is not appropriate here. In Belleville, the decisions that were at issue were vehicle allocation decisions.
Well, in other words, they were commercial decisions made separately each month, just as different insurance checks are coming in that that Wiltshire was presenting each month under this fraudulent.
But, Your Honor, there's a distinction in the facts with Belleville in that, in Belleville, those vehicle allocation decisions were based upon discrete decisions involving ever-changing parameters and factors.
Why isn't the same thing true? It was different patients, different insurance companies, different everything.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. However, if you look at the course of conduct as a whole, what you have is a continuous and ongoing pattern of conduct in which Olin acted in the same manner under two purported letters of authorization.
Well, it's not to say, I don't think that this law requires the absence of any common issue of law or fact. And as you're pointing out, there are some common issues of fact in these different transactions. But I take it you don't disagree that had Dr. Rodriguez chosen to bring a lawsuit on any given check, she could have done so.
Your Honor, she could have done so.
And she could have brought a lawsuit on a three-year chunk of checks.
Correct, but if she had chosen to do that, Your Honor, she, first of all, I believe, could have chosen to act under Field and under Haddad's, which in fact applied the continuing violation
No, Haddad's applies the discovery rule and says it's too late. So
no,
Haddad's
Your Honor,
is not
I respectfully submit. Haddad did look at first the continuing violation rule. They held that the check, the last check, was cashed or deposited more than 3 years.
Well, that's the point. All it says in Haddad's, and I'm quoting, is even if the plaintiff alleged facts that the transactions were part of this common scheme, it's still time barred. So Haddad's, I think, is weak at best for you.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully read it in a different way. Haddad's, while they found the action time barred, they did apply the continuing violation rule and find that where a series of checks is cashed or deposited as part of an ongoing scheme, that scheme constitutes one transaction for purposes of the continuing violation rule. It applies.
It's a commercial. Does any other state interpret the Uniform Commercial Code the way that you're arguing? Or does Illinois stand alone in this odd rule?
Your Honor, I know of no other state that does this. Under the Illinois UCC, Illinois common law determines when a cause of action accrues.
Right, but my point simply is that the U part of the UCC, that the Illinois Supreme Court has said that it is trying to be uniform. So we have law from Illinois that suggests that it's not really trying to be an outlier.
Well, Your Honor, two things on that. First of all, the existing law in Illinois, I believe, does clearly apply the continuing violation rule. And in the Feltmire case, they discussed Fields, on which Haddad relied with approval. The second thing on your uniformity question, if, in fact, each check, and there were 269 third-party checks, was treated as a separate transaction, and this type of argument was rejected both in Fields and Haddad, that they weren't to be treated as separate transactions. Let's say we do that. In theory, that would involve 269 suits.
No, it doesn't, because under Illinois, just as is the case under the federal rules, any plaintiff is entitled to join as many claims as she has in one particular suit.
They
so
already
she brings in 2,000, well, if she wants to be a pain in the neck and bring a million different suits, she could. But the fact is, any plaintiff would be entitled to join as many claims. So if 200 of the checks had been presented and either cashed or deposited, you could join together all 200 claims as long as you were satisfying the statute of limitations.
But in the case where you chose not to, uniformity would not be met because you would have differing outcomes.
No, I mean, it's just, if a plaintiff wants to put herself at risk for that kind of different outcome, and remember, this is all in the plaintiff's hands, then so be it. I mean, maybe the facts are different. Maybe a new letter has appeared. Maybe, you know, somebody picked up the phone and called. Who knows? I mean, that doesn't happen to be this case, but in general it could happen.
Well, Your Honor, and what you have said brings me to another point I would like to address, unless there are additional questions in the continuing violation rule, and that is the fact that Ola never did pick up the phone. We are talking about a seven-year period, 269 checks that they accepted. These were, in fact, third-party insurance checks made payable to Dr. Rodriguez, not Carol Wiltshire, and that were put into Wiltshire's account bearing her name and that of her husband.
But doesn't she deserve to bear at least some of the blame for the wrongdoing here? She's the one who hired Ms. Wiltshire. She's the one who's in the best position to detect the wrongdoing, isn't she?
Well, Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree with your second statement. And she did hire Wiltshire, but she hired her on excellent references. This is not a case, and I believe Your Honor pointed this out earlier, where we have a situation where the checks of the practice, say, were stolen and converted, and, you know, and then she could have checked her own account statement and easily detected the loss. With third-party checks, those checks and the statements for those checks would go back to the issuing insurance company. And in fact, when Ms. Wiltshire called insurance companies during this nine-year period, they gave her a variety of reasons why their payments had not been received. They never told her, hey, we already sent the checks. What are you talking about? She also did not, as counsel has argued, totally turn over control of her office to Ms. Wiltshire and not engage in any supervision. She did, in fact, inspect reports that the DOMS generated. Now, counsel has argued that if she had looked at certain reports earlier, she would have detected the loss much earlier. However, the computer expert, Gary Tremblay, testified that he did not know what advice the doctor was given as to what reports she should run. Even if she had run those daily account reports, in that situation, she would have seen adjustments, but those reports alone would not have told her that a check had been received and had been stolen.
But the amount of the adjustments might have seemed peculiar to
her
because
the
amounts were quite extraordinary.
Yes, Your Honor, might have seemed peculiar. That is
duty of inquiry. I mean, I would imagine seeing $116,000 worth of adjustment in the month of July might have set off a red flag. You know, what in the world is going wrong here, she
mm-hmm.
might have said.
That one month was extraordinarily large. But she also, in addition to reviewing those reports, dealt with three different accounting firms. She read the report that those firms provided her about her practice. And when her practice did begin to go awry, she did not sit idly by. She contacted those accountants. And they said to her to look at her insurance plans, because many of those plans did make delayed payments, to also work on her accounts receivable. And also they told her that this trend she was seeing was not unusual, that this was a trend that was being seen in other physicians' offices. And they
But it was unusual in her own experience, if I remember the record, because prior to 92, when she hired Wiltshire, her rate of uncollectability, if you will, was
been higher.
Was something like 80%, wasn't it?
And correct. It had been higher.
Plummeted after Wiltshire.
Well, it sort of worked up. I mean, we didn't get to the 116 in 1 month instantly, but it did, yes, Your Honor, steadily increase. And that is when she consulted her accountant.
Will the record tell us if she ever brought suit against the accountant?
As far as I know, Your Honor, she did not bring suit against the accountant. She did, of course, as the record reflects, seek out criminal charges against Ms. Wiltshire.
Why didn't she file this civil suit simultaneously with that action, which at least would have relieved us from arguing about one of these years in the statute of limitations?
Well, one reason, as I understand it, was there were a great number of checks that were involved, and these had to be researched, and they had to be looked up on microfilm, which took a great deal of time.
Well, I understand that, but she knew when she hired Wiltshire, and if she had discovered Wiltshire doing this, presumably if she had filed suit right away, it would have picked up whatever Wiltshire did once this research was done. Surely not a Rule 11 violation to file such a suit.
No, and she in fact filed suit a year after.
Right.
Finding out. So it wasn't like a large time had elapsed, but of course by that time, all of the checks had in fact been cashed or deposited. And in this situation too, when you're looking at reasonably commercial standards, we are looking at the standards governing an independent medical practitioner who sees over 70 patients a week. And also, of course, in addition to doing office hours, delivers babies at all hours of the day and night. This is a woman who did rely on her office staff, but also supervised that staff and reviewed the reports provided to her. She did act in a commercially reasonable manner as a doctor, which is what she is. And she did rely on the professional advice that she sought out and received, when in fact she learned of the embezzlement. She did act quickly and began investigating immediately, so it's not as though upon learning she did nothing. And in fact, she had consulted with the accountants before. So as regards the allocation of fault, we believe that the allocation was against the manifest weight of the evidence, that the doctor did everything she could do as a doctor, not as an accountant and a computer expert, to safeguard her account. And I believe that my time is almost up, and I would like to say, would anyone have any questions before I sit down?
Apparently not. You're done?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wisher?
I see I have 1 minute, Your Honors. If there are any questions. No?
You want to use it the way you want to use it? Go ahead.
Well, I think that it was not the plaintiff who called the insurance companies to investigate lack of profitability. I believe Wiltshire made those phone calls. Plaintiff testified she appointed the embezzler to be the investigator of her finances and investigate lack of profitability. Judge Rovner, it says, plaintiff has said there were three sets of accountants. That's not how I remember, but the record says what it says. And finally, Your Honor, when you look at this rule, it's even longer than the discovery rule. As Judge Wood pointed out, something would have alerted you if she'd been looking at her records and saw an adjustment of $116,000 more than her annual salary. And yet, this inequitable result means that the statute runs as to the embezzler, but not as to the bank.
And although my bank had, or my credit union, there was no fraudulent concealment by it, it bears the brunt of this judicially created rule. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks very much. The case will be taken under advisement.